Meghan Markle, I absolutely love you. If you're listening to this, we love you here. Please stay here. Please stay in California. Do you need a pediatrician? Please reach out to me.
From Topic Studios and WarnerMedia Podcast Network, this is Politically Reactive. I'm Debbie Kamau Bell.
And I'm Hari Kondabolu, and I hold grudges, bub. I was angry about the British well before the Meghan Markle interview with Oprah.
We're two friends and stand-up comics and dads trying to make sense of American politics.
But, Kamau, what is politics, really?
Where are you going with this?
I mean, shouldn't a modern, expansive definition of politics include, I don't know, say, basketball? Come on, man, I want to talk about sports! I don't care if we lose fans! I want to talk about sports!
Then we can definitely talk about the NBA, because there's a lot of political activity in and around that league.
That's what I'm talking about! We're talking basketball!
And we're going to be talking about basketball with Mark J. Spears, my friend, frequent appearer on ESPN, and senior NBA writer for The Undefeated. He's so much about that NBA life that when players and coaches went into the bubble in Orlando last year, Mark did too.
We were so insulated in there, I don't think they realized how much of an impact they were having on the outside.
He was also at Sunday's NBA All-Star Game, a game a lot of people thought shouldn't even happen this season.
We'll talk to Mark about how the NBA has become the one major sports league where speaking out against racial injustice isn't just allowed, oh no, it's part of the brand.
They ended up switching their mentality and putting the emphasis on voting, which ultimately opened up basically every arena in the league for voting. You cannot tell me that didn't impact the election.
But before the basketball talk begins, we're going to hear from one of the people who launched Between Us, About Us, a new campaign to provide Black communities with credible information on COVID-19 vaccines.
Oh, are we going to talk to me? Because I was in one of those videos.
Hello, Black America, and people who pay attention to what Black folks are doing. My name's W. Kamau Bell.
No, Kamau. We're going to talk to Dr. Rhea Boyd. Dr. Boyd is a pediatrician, public health advocate, and scholar. She brought together Black physicians, nurses, and scientists, in full disclosure, a certain comedian and podcast host, to counter disinformation about vaccinations.
The point of this campaign isn't for us as Black healthcare workers to tell Black people what to do. We're not trying to be in that same paternalistic relationship with Black communities that the rest of our healthcare system is. I think we're really trying to say, hey, I want to make sure that when you make this choice, you make it with the truth. You make it with actual information. And then whatever choice you make, like, I trust that you'll make the right choice for you.
She also wants to challenge popular misconceptions about Black Americans and their attitudes towards vaccines.
It's not that Black people are vaccine hesitant. As a pediatrician, I know Black parents vaccinate their kids. If you remove all the barriers, if you make vaccination free, if you make access points accessible in people's neighborhoods, Black people are just as likely to get vaccinations as any other racial or ethnic group.
It's all coming up on Politically Reactive.
Hey, Kamau.
Hey, Hari.
Are you excited about our Ambie nomination? I'm excited. I didn't know the Ambies were a thing, but apparently the Podcast Academy is putting out awards called the Ambies, and we're nominated for one.
See, I thought it was best podcast to listen to when you're on Ambien. That's what I thought the Ambies were. But yes, we've been nominated for an award in our... This is our first award nomination? I believe it is.
I was trying to think if it was our... Yeah, I think it is our first award nomination. I'm like, what is the category? First, is it the best podcast hosted by a Black and Indian guy talking about politics? Because if that's the case, we deserve the Lifetime Achievement Award.
Now, what is the category here? You were looking at it?
Yeah, it's best politics or opinion podcast, which is kind of broad, actually.
Well, do people vote on it?
People who are part of the Podcast Academy vote on it, you have to get membership in the Podcast Academy, which we do not have, you and I, so we can't vote for ourselves. So if anyone from the Podcast Academy is listening...
Well, they must be. They nominated us.
They should vote for us. You know, initially I didn't care much because I'm like, who cares? It's a podcast. Who cares about an award? But, you know, after I thought about it, I really want it. I want a little statue. I don't have any little statues. You have multiple Emmys. I don't have anything. Yes. I want an Ambie. I want an Ambie award. And I don't know who's listening And I don't know if begging is the best way to get an AMBY award, but please vote for us because I very much want an AMBY award. I don't even know what it looks like.
Certainly, there's a lot of podcasts out there. Here's the ones we're up against. Burn the Goats. Burn the Goats. I thought it was like about Jamaican cooking. Gaining Ground, The New Georgia, which from Crooked Media. So they're going to win.
Yeah, they'll win.
Yeah. The Brookings Cafeteria, Our Nation of Immigrants. Oh, I guess the podcast is called Our Nation of Immigrants from the Brookings Cafeteria.
Okay.
And then us, and then NPR Politics, which just seems unfair that NPR gets to be in these things.
Yeah.
It's NPR. We call it podcasts. They call it making radio. But right. It just seems unfair. Like whenever you see that, like, Ira Glass is the number one podcast, you're like, that's not fair.
You're cheating. You also have the radio to advertise it. Like, that's not fair.
Winning Wisconsin is another podcast. And then my favorite one, the Dan Bongino Show. Dan Bongino is he's so hardcore right wing that I've blocked him on Twitter.
Wow.
And here's the thing. I don't block every right wing hardcore person, but that, I think at some point he tried to engage with me. And I think, but there are some times where people are on CNN and he's been on CNN and say things. I'm like, I just got to block this person on principle. So I don't know which one it is, if it's a principle block or if it's a personal block.
I'd never listened to his podcast, but the picture of him advertising the podcast, there is a USA flag on the sleeve of his short sleeved shirt, of his t-shirt. Yes. And he has muscles, so immediately I thought, this man must be a right winger.
And he's got a look in his face that is like that. The way that when you walk into public places and somebody looks at you and you go, you know what, I don't need to be here. That's the kind of look he's got on his face. Like when you walk into like a gas station or something, like, I'm just going to drive down the road a little bit. Like, he's got that look on his face.
You think he's a nice guy, though?
No, he's not a nice guy.
Oh, man. All right. Well, I hope he doesn't win then.
You think I block nice guys on Twitter? Does that sound like my
But sometimes people, they act a certain way on Twitter and you meet them, you're like, you're phony, but you're a pretty good guy.
He was an NYPD officer from 1995 to 1999.
Okay. I know those years and a lot of things happened. I believe it was referred to as Giuliani time.
Apparently, he was a Secret Service agent for 5 years. He ran for Congress unsuccessfully, but he's certainly a Trumper.
So we're having him on the show?
Yeah. So coming up on today's episode, we have Dan Bongino. We're going to have
John Bon Jovi. I thought we were having Bon Jovi on. Oh, God damn it, Matt.
Get ready to hear the truth about America on a show that's not immune to the facts with your host, Dan Bongino.
Folks, every single thing you've been told about the 2020 election is wrong. Everything.
So that just gives you a sense of who we're up against. But good luck to him and good luck to everybody. And enjoy. And I'd like to congratulate Crooked Media for winning the category.
They'll absolutely win.
Yeah.
And happier news, even though us being nominated should be happy, but the information you've given me about this John Bon Jovi character is upsetting. Did you see that Meghan Markle interview with Oprah? Prince Harry was there too, but it was really Meghan Markle and Oprah. Oh, man. Yeah. She spilled some tea. And the British love tea come out.
And she spilled it everywhere. How dare she?
All over.
She's spilling all our tea. You're spilling. No. That's English breakfast.
Spill it. Throw it against Buckingham Castle. They did the best not to throw the Queen under the bus, but everybody else is under the bus. That's where they're all hiding right now, right under the bus.
Full disclosure, I have only seen pieces of it, like the pieces that are on Twitter. There's a thing that happens every now and again. We used to talk about this on the other podcast. Me and Kevin Avery had the Denzel Washington podcast that we still have, and it's just in hibernation, but it's my retirement plan. But but we talk about the idea of black people homework, like things that black people need to engage in. It's not about whether you want to see it. You just need to have seen it. And sometimes that happens with like a thing where you see it coming out. Like, for example, Judas and the Black Messiah is black people homework. You need to see that so you can have the conversations, so you can stay current with the culture. a new Beyonce album is Black People Home. You need to listen to it. You need to be able to know how to have the conversation. But then sometimes things come out of nowhere where, like, I didn't know this was Black People Homework until this morning on Twitter when I saw everybody's reaction to it. And I'm like, oh, I guess I need to watch the whole thing, not just the clips, the whole thing. So I have not seen it. I've seen clips of it, but you've seen most of it, right?
Yeah. I'll give you some of the best stuff. So there's the royal family, and then something mm-hmm. they refer to as the firm or the institution. So I guess there's people that like run the show, and then like they're like the studio, and the actors mm-hmm. are the royal family, right? Mm-hmm. And so some of it has to do with personal relations. Prince Charles wasn't there for Harry, you know, when he needed him, and you know, William has a different set of, you know, values and views than Harry does, and there's stuff like that. And then there was some like drama with Kate made Meghan cry about the bridesmaids' dresses, but it was reported that Meghan made Kate cry. And while this stuff's happening, I'm like, this doesn't feel that interesting.
I mean, other than the fact of the royal family, that's just family shit.
Like, yeah, you just know, family
my dad
shit.
My dad wasn't there for me when I needed him. My sister-in-law isn't being cool to me. Like, this is just it's just the fact that it's the royal family makes it seem more important.
The issue was, like, that shit happened, and then the media write stuff about it, and then the royal family usually protects all the other members of the royal family. Like, they make mm-hmm. statements and say, like, that is not true, that didn't happen. And she claims that they never do any of that with her. They never look like protected her back. And then I'm like, well, that maybe, possibly, you know. And at this point, to me, it's still kind of a celebrity story. But then we get to the meat, right? Mm. Apparently, different family members before their son Archie was born were concerned about what his skin color would look like.
So hold up.
There's
Stop
several
right now.
There are several conversations.
There's a
about
conversation
it.
With you.
With Harry.
About how dark your baby is going to be.
And when Oprah's surprised, it's like, whoa, this is something. So that came out that Archie, the son, who is not going to be a prince, and it's not explained. It was never explained to Harry and Meghan why he wasn't going to be a prince. But I think we know because he's technically not part of the royal family because he's not a prince. He's not getting security. He's a baby. and he's not going to get security even. So he might get killed because he's not a fit. Like, what's wrong with you? He's a baby. And then Meghan might not get security. And then they were going to take Harry's security away, which is ridiculous. And apparently he got cut off from his family. And he doesn't have any skills. He doesn't have any way to make money. Like, she's
now, wait, are you
the
talking
one.
About the, wait, are you talking about the baby or are you talking about Harry?
Both.
Okay.
And, like, Meghan actually is the one who has, like, life skills. And she's a fucking actress. Like, when the actress is the one that has, like, the real job skills, you're in trouble. The monarchy does not look good at the end of this. I would argue they never looked good. But if you're someone who doesn't have that almost innate hatred of the monarchy because you were, you know, part of a subjugated people, a colonized people, you hate them now because of how they treated Meghan. Now, just imagine how they treated Meghan, except it's people of color all over the world for hundreds of years. All
yes,
right.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't even tell you the biggest thing come out. Holy shit. I'm missing the biggest thing. So, and then Meghan talked about how she got so low because, like, she wasn't really left out, like, allowed to leave the castle. And they had these long tours where they would do royal business, where they're basically putting on a show in different countries. And they had this big Australia tour. But they basically, like, you know, they work you to the bone and they kind of control what you can say and when you're out in public and stuff. And she said that, like, it, you know, the treatment that she was receiving and the way she was burned out, she thought about killing herself. Mm-hmm. And she, like, said that in the interview, and she said, like, she told people, like, in the firm, I guess, the people who run the show, and nobody got her help, nobody supported her, nobody was looking out for her best interest at all. And this is what helped lead to, like, them leaving. And it's such a fucking gutsy thing to talk about for anybody, especially when you're a woman of color in this absurd situation. Being a person of color around white people Mm-hmm. When you're the only person of color is difficult. Being a person of color in with white people who are your family is even more difficult. Being a person of color and being the only one and your family is the British royal family, I cannot even imagine how difficult that is. And so for her to say this shit is like so brave. Like at the end of the day, like Meghan is truly the hero in this story. And it's weird because normally I don't give a shit about this stuff at all. But her being there as a woman of color and telling her truth and in some ways, maybe without intending to, fucking up the royal family makes me so happy. If her name was Meghna Mukherjee and she was Indian, that's the only thing that would elevate this story slightly for me, for the immediate colonial justice. So that's basically what happened, Kamau. And it was a joy, friend. It was a joy to watch.
That's funny. That's funny.
It was great seeing Oprah back in action.
Yeah, Oprah's. Oh, I really have enjoyed Oprah. Like, there was clips of her on CBS this morning. It's fun to be able to talk to your best friend
on CBS. On national
TV. Why don't we have a conversation on national TV? And the look on Oprah's face was a little bit like Michael Jordan post baseball. Jay-Z when he returned, like, y'all forgot about me? you thought I was done?
Oprah was our queen. Do you know what I mean? She still might be. Though Beyonce certainly, I think, has a stake.
No, but Oprah is definitely like, I think you're right. I think if there's anybody in American media who can sort of stand up to the royal family,
it's Oprah.
It's Oprah. I mean, for me, I remember from the very early, like being like afraid for her. Like, oh no, like you can't marry into that family. Like, you know, it felt like that's when you find out who your good friends and family are. Because somebody should have said, Meghan, can I come talk to you for a second? Because somebody should have pulled her coat. Because I just feel like I was afraid for her. And I'm not I don't know deep stuff about the royal family. But I do know enough to know what Diana went through. I'm of the right age where I saw that played out. And I was like, so this is like Diana, but black and divorced and American. Like, you know, like she's, and not 22. She's like, she was in her mid-30s. You know what I mean? Like all these things. I was like, this is going to be hard. And then I remember after she got married, there was a thing where she was like one of her first official, like out in the world, meeting the common folks in England. And there was a story that I read that said that somebody said, can you take a selfie with me? And she said, oh, we don't take selfies. And I was like, oh, somebody had to sit Meghan Markle down. And it wasn't it was somebody from the firm, now that I know that's the term. It was not a family member, and go through all the shit you don't do anymore. She had to turn off her social media. She had to quit her job on Suits. You know what I mean? Which I felt like, you can't act anymore. You can't be on, like, you know, we don't do basic cable. Somebody in this firm probably had to sit her down and go through all the things you can't do that probably aren't written down because these people just know it.
Well, that's what happened. Like she talks about in the interview is that like they didn't go over a lot of things like how to properly curtsy and that.
Yeah, I saw that. She had to, somebody, this is the thing. On the way to meet the queen, he was like, oh, shoot, do you know how to curtsy?
Yeah. No, because it's, the 21st century. Queens where I'm from other than a place in New York because it's the real world. We don't live in a fucking fairy tale.
Between this and the ties that the royal family has to Jeffrey Epstein, it's just like, it's good to see all this come out because you can have it. You can have a royal family if you want to. But the idea that these people are different than regular people is ridiculous.
Also, and the fact that Andrew might have been having sex with children and everyone's giving Meghan Markle shit?
Yeah.
Also, remember when Harry wore a Nazi uniform for Halloween and he was canceled? He's been renewed.
We're not here just as a Meghan Markle podcast. We have other things to talk about this week, although there may be some more Meghan Markle talk. A couple shows back, Hari, you started a conversation about the NBA with Mark Lamont Hill.
Yeah.
Although, to be fair, he ended the conversation,
oh,
if you recall.
Yeah.
But this week, we're going to be talking to a professional basketball expert, writer Mark J. Spears, my friend and senior NBA writer for The Undefeated.
We talked to Mark about the politics of basketball, racial justice, COVID, his experience inside the NBA bubble last year, also how my Knicks are on the upswing and whether we'll ever win a championship. But first, aren't we going to talk about one of your new projects, Kamau? Is that right?
Yes, one of my new projects. I'm involved in this project, which is saving people from COVID.
That's a good project. That's a good one.
But I wouldn't call it mine. I was invited to be a part of this project, Between Us, About Us, by Dr. Rhea Boyd. She's one of the key people behind this new campaign to get credible information about COVID vaccines into Black communities. And it's Between Us, About Us, because it is created by, starring, and produced by Black people. And some white people I recommended who know how to act right.
Dr. Rhea Boyd is a pediatrician, public health advocate, and scholar.
She writes and teaches about racism and health, and she's one of the driving forces behind Between Us, About Us, a new campaign to get real answers about COVID vaccines out to Black communities.
You can learn more at betweenusaboutus.org or just listen to Rhea right now.
But I mean, of course you want to go to the site because that's how you get to see the video that I'm in. It's like 5 minutes long. I make funny faces. It's gold, Jerry. It's gold.
Right now.
First of all, I'd like to apologize before we get started. I'd like to make a full-throat apology for not being more famous to get more people's eyes on this. I'd like to apologize for not being Kevin Hart or Chris Rock. I can't be like, why couldn't they get a more famous person? So thank you for inviting me to be a part of the project.
Are you joking? People love you. I did like a round of media going just to like local radio, local TV in Chicago and Kansas City and Birmingham, Alabama. And the first question everyone wanted to talk about was like, how'd you get W. Kamau Bell?
And you're like, I know him. I just said, hey, do this. And I told him to do it. And he said, okay, yeah.
I'm kind of amazed because I've been waiting for Kamau to apologize to me for not being Kevin Hart for years. And wow, you've already gotten it. Wow.
We can't tell you how enormous and overwhelming the response has been. And the launch video, like the main video that you're in that covers multiple questions and not just one, is the most popular by far. I think this is the most viewed video just in the 4 days it's been up that Kaiser Family Foundation has ever had. So wow. Thank you.
Finally, I get a viral video on a virus. That's how my career works. But you don't have to talk about me. Thank you for complimenting me. But how has the response been so far to this video?
Honestly, we've had as a team, as a production team, a number of really emotional moments. Like, moments of just hearing from folks who said, we use the video. Doctor who reached out and said, hey, I had a patient in the ER who wasn't sure. We showed him the video and that patient left deciding to get the vaccine. Mm. There were people in my own family network I could not convince, but we showed them that video with you and they said, wow, that was pretty funny. That was pretty straightforward, you know? And then they're like, we're gonna get it now. It's been incredible. We even had a response from here in the Bay Area where, you know, both of us are residents. One of our local jail systems wants to play our videos within the jails, which was a conversation we had early on, like how we truly intend to reach every single Black person in the country and how will we do it? And because the product that we created was so accessible, and because you made that conversation so accessible to people by making it a little bit light and funny and the way Black folks just talk to each other, you know, people have wanted to share it everywhere. You know, it's going to be shared on a Sunday service in Ebenezer Baptist Church, which is the church that was right beside of the 16th Street. We cried. We cried when the pastor said they loved it and wanted to share it. Like, it's, I'm getting goosebumps right now just saying that. Like, it's been incredible.
I just ran into one of the parents of the school my daughter goes to. And she's a doctor, and she's very like low key. She's like, I saw it, it's pretty good. And I was like, oh man. And she goes, I'm gonna use that to get patients. And I was like, oh yay! So I mean, it is one of those times that I tweeted this out that it does feel like to have heard that one person like use the video that it got them to take the vaccine is incredible. It's very remarkable. I mean, it's funny. This whole thing started was like somebody asked Dan Roth, our friend.
Yeah.
Asked me to recommend a production company, and I recommended my friend Adam Mansbach, who's writes and produces stuff. And then he came back and goes, "Yeah, you're going to host it." I was like, "How did that happen?"
It was amazing. But
it's just to see sort of how this sort of started and to see where it's at. It's just it's one of the great things I've been associated with in my career. So thank you for that.
That means a lot. I mean, it's honestly how I feel. I feel like this is some of the most important work I've ever done, honestly. The other work I do is around like teaching folks about the connections between racism and health. I like publish in our medical literature. I do a little bit of writing for lay media, and obviously I'm a doctor in real life.
Yeah.
But to affect this many people over something that's just so critical, it's been an enormous honor.
You've really talked about the idea of like people, the way the press frames this, the way the press frames this issue, and how it's framed in a way that puts the burden on the black folks, and not in a way that puts the burden on the system, and not in a way that puts the burden on explaining, on doing a better job of connecting with people.
Part of why we wanted to let people know that this is created by black folks for black folks was like, we're not going to label you. We're not going to be dismissive of your concerns. We know your concerns are absolutely legitimate. The number one concerns that black folks have are the same concerns that white folks have, that Latinx populations have, that our health system has. The number one concern is this vaccine safe? That's the reason we do clinical trials. Like, we as black folks, I just feel like knew going into this process that it's not that black people are vaccine hesitant. As a pediatrician, I know black parents vaccinate their kids. And I tried to kind of share that in my piece in the New York Times, which was very cool. Like, to just be like, you know, we know black people get vaccinated. If you remove all the barriers, if you make vaccination free, if you make access points accessible in people's neighborhoods, if you make sure that everyone has an insurance plan that actually covers vaccination, and then if your provider just offers it to you, black people are just as likely to get vaccinations as any other racial or ethnic group. And so we wanted to avoid that language around hesitancy, which kind of blames black people. It says, oh, you're not getting the vaccine because of your own choices or your own attitudes. And instead, we're like, we know the reason that you're not getting this vaccine is because you have legitimate concerns that need to be responded to before, you know, you're comfortable making this choice.
As the vaccine is rolled out, have we learned anything new about what's keeping black people from getting vaccinated?
What we saw, and what maybe people are labeling hesitancy, is that a sizable proportion of black folks said, if you ask them, like, if you had access to the vaccine right now, would you get it? A sizable proportion of black folks said, I'm waiting to see. But waiting to see didn't mean, I don't like vaccinations, I don't trust vaccinations, I'm definitely never getting it. It's like, I want to see how this goes first, which is completely reasonable. And so now we're going back to that same population that was about 37%, like more than a third of black folks said that last time Kaiser Family Foundation asked back in February. You know, we're going back to that population and we're saying, now that you waited, which is a reasonable choice, more than 50 million people have gotten the vaccine. And our country has put up the most careful process to actually watch each of those people to make sure that we know even what could be rare side effects. And given now, not just the data from the clinical trials, which was really reassuring, but was only on tens of thousands of people, now we have data on tens of millions of people to be able to say, like, you've waited, the data is in, and here is the evidence for you to decide now. People were waiting, and so we have to actually go back to them and follow up and say, now we know some different things.
Well, we had the legendary poet Nikki Giovanni on our podcast a few weeks ago, and we were talking about the vaccine.
Wait, I feel like the people listening to the podcast won't be able to understand the face that Dr. Boy just made. the jaw went slack, the eyes got bigger. She's putting her head down. She's holding her head, as Yolanda Le Van Zandt would say. She's taking a breath.
Whoa.
Yeah, it was amazing. And we were talking about the vaccine with her, and, you know, she seemed like she was in no rush to get it, and she was pretty blunt about it. She said, I'm going to wait to see what happens to the white folks who get it. And if it seems okay from there, like, we'll do it. But I love the idea, like, she's treating white people as guinea pigs. Like, that's like, you know, like, oh, this is historic justice. This turns it around. But how do you quell those fears?
one-on-one in conversations when I'm talking to patients or if I'm talking to my own family as they've had to make these choices, I've said, you know, that guinea pig idea is really pervasive and it's persuasive to people. It's like, I don't want to be the first in line. And I right. said, look, you weren't the first in line by a long shot, even right now. Like, some of you can't even get in line right now to get it. And if we really look at who was first in line, I think in part, right, I'm not going to ever refute Nikki Giovanni, the queen Nikki Giovanni. I'm going to say, like, it is true that mostly white folks got it first because we gave it to healthcare workers first. And we have a workforce that's predominantly white at every level. You know, whether you're talking about nurses, doctors, students, residents in hospitals, like, we have a workforce that's predominantly white. So she's right. Predominantly white folks got it. And the public should know that healthcare workers got it. People who are both in the line of fire, who are regularly exposed to COVID, but also who have some insight into the scientific process, who know a bit about how vaccines work, who had the information they needed to make a choice on a relative short order. And so now people have had more time than we had and can see how it's affected us as a workforce.
I think her logic was, if those white folks who got it earlier are still alive in a month, she's down to take it.
that was her scientific process.
Yeah,
I mean, that's real. I got it back in December and here I am. So
yeah, right. There you go.
I mean, there's a part of this that about figuring out how to do this in a way that it landed with black people in a way that not only are we casting black doctors and black nurses and black researchers in here, but that the information feels like it was created by black folks. You know what I mean? That it doesn't get so thinned and so corporate that it just feels like, oh, they cast a bunch of black faces, you know? And I think a lot of people who've said that, I'm like, oh, you didn't watch it. But can you talk about that process of making sure it feels like it's not only black people talking about it, it's black people who brought you this information and created this?
This wasn't cast. This was black doctors behind the scenes who know each other because we came up together in medical school and training, and we've worked alongside each other of various ages who just called the black folks we knew. You know, I just said, girl, I'm putting this together. We're all worried about what's going on. Can you jump on this? And then Dr. Kira Perry said, absolutely. Right? Like, I personally didn't know Dr. Montgomery Rice, the dean of Morehouse School of Medicine, but one of our partners, Dr. Reed Tuckson, who is her contemporary, he knew her and said the same thing. Girl, can you help us out? We really just need to put this on. It was a labor of love for us. Everybody we asked said yes. People came in the middle of running major COVID testing sites, COVID clinical sites. Like, people came in the middle of doing all of the things we're doing to show up in community, to be here to show up nationally for black people. I saw some tweet online that said, like, oh, but they're paid by pharmaceutical companies. Please, people gave up of their time freely and generously because we love black people that much, because it felt like we were talking to our own families when we had these conversations, and because we want black folks to have this information that they're so deserving of having.
In terms of vaccination sites that are targeted towards people of color and especially the black community, do you see black doctors there? Do you see black medical professionals? Is there an attempt to, like, diversify how the vaccine is being given?
I mean, first of all, just credit and shout out to all the black healthcare workers across the country who have been hustling and sprinting for a year. Like, as racial health inequities emerged, as we knew that communities of color and particularly predominantly black areas of the country were hardest hit by the pandemic, like, black healthcare workers immediately propped up testing sites, propped up, like, areas where you can go in to just get checked if you have symptoms of COVID, started making sure that people could have pulse oxes at home. Like, there's just been so many efforts on a small scale that don't get captured always in national media that have been just driven by black doctors making sure the communities that they serve had what they needed. And I think that's a huge part of the story, that although our healthcare system has not been a welcoming place and has not served black folks with dignity and with love, black healthcare providers went above and beyond to make sure in this pandemic that we were showing up for people. The other thing we know is that for health messaging in particular, black patients as a patient population, more than any other racial or ethnic group, respond to health messaging when it features a provider who looks like them, when it features another black clinician. So this is why we called it Between Us, About Us. It wasn't just random language we pulled. It's because we know what black folks know what For Us, By Us means. And We also know we couldn't steal for us by us, so we said, you know.
Damon John's not ready to give that up or license that.
Exactly. We're not going to break copyright here, but we're going to call it Between Us About Us. Black folks will recognize that, and it will truly be just between us, so that when you look at this video, when you see this content, you are just talking black person to black person, just like you might in your home or community.
I've seen you in my Twitter comment threads, sort of like going like, hold on a second, let me just answer some questions. Why do you feel compelled to do that? Why do you feel compelled? I mean, you've written an op-ed, you did a lot of work to put this together. As you say, you also are a doctor, like you're doing a lot of work. What is it about that makes you feel compelled to sort of like, and I see you do it in a way that is gentle, not in the way that I always do it, so I'm learning. But what makes you do that?
When I said to our team, I want us to get this information in front of every black person in the country, I really meant that seriously. And whether people, you know, send me a message on Twitter, whether I see something that you say on Shade Room, because I go to Shade Room just like the rest of us, you know, I'm going to respond. I'm going to let you know, hey, if you haven't seen this, here's some more references. And actually, that thing that you said isn't true. And it's important for people to understand, like, the point of this campaign isn't for us as black healthcare workers to tell black people what to do. We're not trying to be in that same paternalistic relationship with black communities that the rest of our healthcare system is. I think we're really trying to say, hey, I want to make sure that when you make this choice, you make it with the truth. You make it with actual information. And then whatever choice you make, like, I trust that you'll make, you know, the right choice for you. But, you know, sometimes if we're going to get to everybody, sometimes that means I just got to pull somebody aside and say, hey, I saw that. No, that's not how it is.
And the other thing I would say is some of this misinformation is coming from maybe the hardest place to deal within the black community, but the black clergy or black religious groups. Historically, places that like were the only places black folks could trust was the church, or the only place we could feel safe was on Sundays in those churches, or whatever your, doesn't have to be the Christian church, could be any religious doctrine, he says, trying not to get canceled. when it's wrapped up in God and religion, it becomes much harder to say, it becomes religion versus science, which is not what I think was intended.
I think one of the ways that like anti-black racism shows up in our country is in the exclusion of black folks from getting to be a part of the health sciences. You know, even if we wanted black doctors to go door to door, just black doctors, like there's not enough of us to tell everybody. And part of why we hear other prominent messengers carry and share misinformation is because they don't have a direct connection within their network to an actual black healthcare provider, because there's so few of us. There's only 4% of the physician workforce is black. It's the same for residents, like the pipeline of people leading up to be doctors, only 4% is black. That would never be enough to even meet our percentage of the population in the US, 13%, let alone enough to like actually send people around to tell people information. And so it's part of why we wanted to build a campaign that could live online so we could reach more people than we might be able to reach one-on-one through our own patient practice. And so everybody could say, even though I might not have a healthcare provider and I might not know this information, like there's a healthcare provider and they work for a place that I understand, like Morehouse School of Medicine, I can trust that the information they're giving me is credible. So we're hoping to kind of seed the community with just credible information that then hopefully will be picked up by clergy and shared, you know, in spaces of worship and spaces of just like recreation, like barbershops, parks, kickbacks, like that people might just infuse this information into the natural conversations we know they're already having about it.
The highest risk group is older black folks. How do we convince older black folks when you're also trying to be respectful? You know what I mean? Like, it's just sort of like, I think about like, even in the Nikki Giovanni conversation, I was like, I have things to say, but I'm not going to correct Nikki Giovanni. Like, I'm just going to like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I think that exists outside of even icons like Nikki Giovanni, like your grandmother or your uncle or, you know, that black lady at church that you're like, that's not actually the right thing. How do we engage there?
You know, I had the conversation with my own big mama, with my grandmother, and she called me and she said, you know, Rhea, my doctor called me up. She lives in rural Missouri. And she said, you know, my doctor said, I need to go get this shot, but I'm not sure. Like, what do you think? And, you know, I'm the healthcare provider my family knows. And so I was so glad she reached out. And first I was just like, oh, thank you, big mama, so much for reaching out. Like, let's talk. Tell me about your main concern. What's your worry? And, you know, she shared similar things that we cover on the video. Like, I'm worried this happened so fast. I'm worried this started during the Trump administration. Maybe he was trying to get some political gain. And so maybe they skipped some steps here. Like, tell me more about it. And so then we literally just talked about it. And then her next concern was just like, well, what arm should I get it in? Because, you know, I don't want to get it in my bad arm. And so then I was just telling her, you know, what arm I got it in, what side effects I had, which are common. And I want people to know you are going to feel your immune system kick in when you get these vaccines because they're so effective. So you might feel some body aches or arm soreness like we talked about. You might feel a little bit of headache, a little bit of dizziness, fatigue, even fever. And all of that would be a normal response. So I told her that because some of her friends had told her that they got sick from the vaccine. And what I said to her was, oh, I'm so glad you said that. They're not sick from the vaccine. Actually, when you get sick, part of those feelings that you have is your immune system working. And so they didn't get sick from the vaccine. That was their immune system kicking in. And she was a nurse. So even though she's, you know, in her mid, in her later years, I'll say, she wouldn't want to say her age on here. She got it, you know, she got it. And she ended up getting the vaccine. And you know what she said to me too? She said when she pulled up, there was only four black people in line. That when she showed up, she was looking for other black people who were getting the vaccine to also feel reassured in her choice. So I'll also say to other black folks, like, you making that choice, once you access the information and make the choice to get it, if you decide to, like, it means a lot for the other black folks around you in your household and even just strangers who show up in line with you to see that you're making the choice too.
Everybody I know is now a parent of my kid's school. Like, I don't know any people. I'm realizing everybody I'm referencing is another parent from school who actually is a healthcare worker and has worked on the COVID wards and all these things. And she was talking about the fact, and she's not black, but she was talking about the fact that a lot of the black healthcare people, maybe not the doctors, but the people who work in hospitals, the staff, are not sure about the vaccine. And you just hear that and you're just like, oh no, like they're there. I would expect that if you were there every day and seeing it, that you would have you'd feel better about it. But those people are, it's also just also nervous.
That's super real. And it's actually one of the focuses of our outreach since we've launched the campaign. So what we saw is that among group 1A, the people who were kind of the quote unquote guinea pigs, the people who had first priority to receive the vaccine, among that healthcare group of workers, long-term care workers and home health aides who are populations of our workforce who tend to be predominantly black, and then like environmental health workers who also tend to be Latinx as well, up to 2/3 decided not to get it. So most people decided, you know what, I'm going to pass completely or I'm going to wait and see. And we're hoping that a lot of that percentage was actually folks who are just waiting to see, that we can then go back to and have a conversation directly with. And what we're finding is people across our workforce who made the choice not to get it, they don't always want to hear from somebody who's in like a supervisor role from them. You know, like the home health aide doesn't want to hear it from a doctor. They want to hear from another home health aide who also made the choice to get it, what information helped push them or shift them to make that choice. And so we're also trying to craft these peer-to-peer conversations so that people can talk with somebody who has their same role, knows, you know, their same struggles. I think we're seeing the same thing happen with teachers. I think people are suspect of the power dynamic that exists. And I'm a part of a professional organization, the American Academy of Pediatrics, who has said from early on, like, we can find a safe way for kids to be back in schools. And we have seen now, like, a divide between teachers and parents, sometimes a racial divide between the population whose schools serve and the people who work in the school, about who needs to be back in school. And what people don't want is somebody from above saying, you know, get yourself back in school, regardless of the ways that we're going to protect you. People want to hear from another teacher saying, hey, this is what we did in my classroom to make it safe, and this is how I got the vaccine. They want to filter out the power dynamics that might lead somebody else to kind of influence them to make a choice that's not necessarily in their interest, but is in the interest of the system. They want to hear from somebody who's just not talking about the system and just talking about you as an individual.
One of the things I've heard from posting the video is some black people are like, you don't got to convince me, but I don't have access. Like, you know, like, yeah. I don't, you know, my problem isn't that I don't believe in it. My problem is I believe in it, but I can't get to it, or it's not available to me yet. Is there anything to do about that access problem now? Is it just, I mean, is it just baked in? Is there something we can do? Because I feel like that's a, if you have black people with their arms up, it feels like to me, if you're a black person who wants it, and maybe I'm biased, you should just be at the head of the line because it will help more black people get the vaccine.
This is a hard question to crack. It's like a hard problem to crack because part of what's happening is a separation between who has power over who gets the vaccine. So the federal government, right, wants to give the vaccine out in a way that's equitable now under the Biden administration. They've said that multiple times. They have Dr. Nunez Smith leading their equity campaign. She's been a wonderful and enthusiastic supporter of this project, Between Us About Us. And so we know that they want to get it to people who are most impacted. But they actually don't control what states do with their vaccine supply. They distribute it to states and then states can decide. So where they have a lot of power is over the pharmacies, actually, who directly contract with the federal government to then give out vaccine. And so through that power, they were able to say, you can go to any pharmacy if you're a teacher and get the vaccine, which is wonderful for our teachers of color and for teachers generally who are going back into schools. But then everybody else is kind of at the mercy of their state. And if you don't live in a progressive state, you know, like California, you may not know a horizon on which, you know, you might get the vaccine. And that's really hard for people. So one of the things that we're working on is partnering with organizations that also have control over the local vaccine supply. In our ideal scenario, we would roll out information to communities through pushing them information on social media and online, but actually through door-to-door organizing where people show up in rural areas, particularly in the South, and just say, hey, do you know the vaccine site's about to open? Do you have any questions about that? Here's some information from Between Us About Us. So we're in talks to partner to do things like that so that by the time the vaccine supply does come to you, you've already had enough time to digest the information so that you feel ready to make the choice. I think we will have enough doses for everybody. But at the moment, people are still being prioritized for who gets to get it. So if it's open to people, we want you to be ready. So we're working on making sure that we pair the information with access. And we know a lot of people who are working to bring that access right to Black folks' neighborhoods.
And then there's just the weird thing of happening. And I may or may not be telling a story about the white half of my family that comes through my wife of just sort of like being in the right place at the right time and they just give you the vaccine even though you're not in any group that needs the vaccine. I may have heard a story where I was like, him? like just because he was at the right, but the quote unquote right place at the right time and in the right neighborhood, in the right city, in the white, I'd just be saying white, in the white part of the white state of the white wealthy, blah, blah, blah.
And that's what it is, that we know that there's a structural process that has shaped who's at that right place and right time and who's the right population. And you're absolutely right. It tends to be folks who are white and folks who are wealthy. And so there is an effort to shift that, to say, we know we built it that way so that it's easy for you to be in that right place, right time. And the ways for us to build it another way exist. For one example, like if you use an online or phone-based sign up, people of color are not going to sign up to get the vaccine, particularly if you live in the South where you don't have reliable internet access. Again, from that same report from Fair Count, they saw that, you know, 1 in 10 folks across the South don't even have access to the internet. In Arkansas, it was something like 1 in 5 people. And so if that's the only way for you to sign up, you'll never be at the right place because you don't even have the internet. And so ones that are working really well are like what they've done in Philly, the Black Consortium, where it's like, there is no sign up. We put it in your neighborhood. When you get off work, just come stand in the line and we'll give out every single vaccine till we're done. And people stand in line and the line goes around the block and they get it.
Thank you so much for doing this. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This is honestly such an honor and a delight.
Dr. Rhea Boyd is a pediatrician, public health advocate, and scholar.
She writes and teaches about racism and health and helped create Between Us About Us, a new campaign to get real answers about COVID vaccines out to Black communities.
It turns out this information is good no matter what race you are. Watch and share some highly informative and occasionally entertaining videos featuring Black healthcare workers, Black scientists, and yours truly at betweenusaboutus.org. That's betweenusaboutus.org.
Coming up, we'll talk about the NBA and politics with veteran pro basketball reporter Mark J. Spears. Mark J. Spears is the senior NBA writer for The Undefeated.
He's a hardcore NBA journalist. When NBA players and coaches went into the bubble in Orlando last year, Mark went right in there with him. and on Sunday he was in Atlanta to cover his 21st NBA All-Star game.
His most recent book is The Spencer Haywood Rule, Battles, Basketball, and the Making of an American Iconoclast.
Let's talk to Mark. So thank you for joining us. I appreciate it. It's good to see you, brother.
Man, it's good to be seen, man. I just was in Atlanta for probably the most unusual NBA All-Star game in world history. If you didn't know there was an All-Star game going on there, you wouldn't have known. It was just like no commotion, no energy, no nothing. Nothing that even suggested that the best players of the world were about to be inside this building. Yeah, it was weird and it was sad because it was actually like a really cool event with all these HBCU things going on that you couldn't see on TV. And the fans that, like the friends and family crowd, as I call it, that were there seemed to be like enjoying all that. But, you know, the public couldn't see it.
You go to the All-Star Games regularly because that's your job. And Atlanta is one of those cities that when the All-Star Game is scheduled in Atlanta, the players and the fans are like, oh, it's going to be turnt. Like, it's going to be a 24-hour party for the whole time, right? And so was it a lot different?
I think the party still went on to the NBA. The NBA wasn't happy about it. I saw that they actually put out 200 cease and desist letters for using like NBA All-Star players, pictures and stuff in promotion. So, I mean, I wasn't at the party, and I promise you I didn't go to Magic City. But apparently there were a bunch of parties going on, which is why I stayed at this hotel called The Glen that was really, really close. But it was like literally like a ghost town downtown. It's just so odd because NBA All-Star is like a family reunion. You'll walk into a hotel and hey, that's Dr. J right there. It's like all my childhood legends, all the posters that I had on my wall, they're all like walking around and you see them with the young players and intermingling and other celebrities. And literally this time it was just the players and they're like family members. And even like Dwayne Wade, he couldn't be on the floor. There was like some perch over the floor where Gladys Knight couldn't sing on the floor. She didn't sing on the floor. She sang from this perch. And so did like Dwayne Wade made some presentation from this perch. And the Hawks dancers, that's where they dance from. But hopefully it'll be the last time we have to have this sterile environment.
You and the people who lived in the bubble, I mean, I think it's one of the most unique things that's ever happened in the history of the world. Like just that NBA bubble, I was so fascinated about. And you had to go in there. Can you talk a little bit about what it was like? Did they invite you in? Did you have to apply? How that whole process went down?
ESPN and Undefeated put in a request. And I think that they knew with my job covering race and the NBA for the Undefeated. I think they figured, and I kind of warned them, I'm like, something's going to go down, okay? Mm-hmm. With everything happening in the world, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and eventually what happened in Kenosha during the bubble, I'm like, trust me, I think y'all want me up there talking about it. You know, Woj can't do everything. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know if he wants to break news on social justice. So,
like, yeah, I don't know if he wants, those Woj bombs, as they call them. I don't think he's interested in those kind of Woj bombs.
So initially, I thought I was, I thought I was going to be there like a month and that they were going to switch me out. Month became 2 months, and I was like, oh. They want to make sure I'm there in case, hell breaks loose again, and I felt literally like I was the safest place on earth. Mm. We were getting tested every day and everybody in there was getting tested and we weren't allowed to the outside world. And only time we were like, we would go see what the world was doing is when we take the bus to the venues. I told the bus driver, I'm like, hey man, I'll give you $100 if you take me to the McDonald's drive-thru. He's like, what? Like, I just want a quarter pounder with cheese, man. That's all. I'm willing to give you $100 so I can get a quarter pounder with cheese. Like, we were eating. I never ate so many peanut butter and jelly sandwiches in my life, man. My God. Was like the go-to snack in there. But to be there when the players, after Jacob Blake got shot, to see them shut down the league for 3 days and turn the sports world on its back, that was one of the most incredible things I've ever been around. When people were worried about them leaving, and I didn't have a sense that they were, but it was certainly very tense at that time.
Can you talk about kind of what went into that decision? Because I know that the Bucks had decided that they were not going to play a playoff game that day. I know there was some. It sounded like there was some frustration that it wasn't a coordinated effort with the players' union or with the other teams. And also there was that, you know, there was a couple of days there where we were wondering whether the season would continue, and there were rumors that like LeBron wanted the season to end. How much of that is true? Like, did LeBron want the season to end in response to the Jacob Blake shooting? And was that a realistic possibility? Was there frustration that the Bucks did this kind of unilaterally?
Oh man, George Hill is one of the most fascinating people I've ever met. Brilliant play, basketball mind, but also just a brilliant guy. He has a ranch in San Antonio that's like basically like some amusement park with zebras and cows and like a fishing ponds. And the players say, like, when players looking at cars and clothing online, he's looking at animals. So he's a very, very unique guy. But he's from like the hood of Indianapolis, probably could have died 40 times.
Wow.
In fact, before he went to the bubble, he went to a picnic to honor one of his cousins that was murdered. And there was a drive-by shooting on the park grounds where he had to like grab his son out of a jumpy, make sure both their lives were saved. So he's been through a lot, man. He lives on a farm now, but he's grew up in the hood around a lot of gang violence. So he has a lot to say and has certainly experienced a lot. He also has a sauerkraut company. Very interesting.
What?
Yeah, he owns a company that's really good called Cleveland Kraut. Told you, he's the most interesting man in the NBA. So after Jacob Blake was shot, he comes up to me after their game, the day after, and he goes, man, before he did his media availability, he goes, man, I'm tired of these crooked-ass cops, man. And I'm like, wow, okay. When he told me that, that's when I got the sense that the NBA temperature was turning up.
He was playing for the Bucks at that point.
Yeah, right? He's playing for the Bucks. He's now at Oklahoma City, but he was playing with the Bucks at the time. And the next day, Doc Rivers had that really emotional plea about, like, why don't they like us? That same night, the Bucks, you know, were certainly talking about things behind the scenes, but the Celtics and the Raptors actually had a private meeting in which they discussed not playing.
Wow.
They had decided that they were going to meet again the next day, because I don't think they played again the Thursday, about whether or not to boycott or not. And I'm sure the Bucks and George Hill got wind of it. George Hill tells his coach, Mike Budenholzer, and their four black assistant coach, to meet him for lunch at the one of the few restaurants in the bubble. So they meet for lunch, and he tells them that he's not playing. He just wanted to let them know. He said he was going to attend the game out of, you know, respect of his teammates and the organization, but he was not going to play. So he shows up at the arena, and keep in mind, and this is all coincidental, the Bucks had the first game of the day, the first playoff game of the day, and they're playing the Orlando Magic. The Orlando Magic had, like, reached out to the Bucks to see if there was something they should be looking out for. And the Bucks apparently told them no. Like, no, I mean, maybe they told them George Hill wasn't playing, but they were expected to play. So the Bucks went, I mean, the Magic came there fully expecting to play in a playoff game that started at 4 o'clock. Apparently in the locker room with about 20 minutes left, the players started talking to George about why he wasn't playing. Then they had another player who had a police brutality incident in Milwaukee by the name of Sterling Brown, who's now with the Rockets. Sterling says, you know what, I'm not going to play either. And they were also connected to Jacob Blake because this was in their state, the state that they played in. This was in Wisconsin. So I think that weighed on them a little bit as well. This was in their state, and they wanted to make a statement. So they decided, like with about 10 minutes left before the game started, not to play. I didn't really understand, like, the backlash that they got. All them other teams could have decided not to play on their own or to play. They didn't have to follow what the Bucks did. They shouldn't have felt pressured to follow what the Bucks did. They're grown men. They make their own decisions. So apparently a guy from the Lakers, like the Lakers take a team nap like they all nap around apparently at the same time around 3 o'clock or something. In the game. Like,
that definitely started weird. When like, LeBron got when I, this.
Yeah, like when I first pictured this, like I felt like, what is it, LeBron and AD and the rest of the team is like laying on the ground in one room, like holding blankets or something. Like, so they all take a nap. So
if LeBron says it's time to take a nap, it's time to take a nap.
Yeah, but apparently they were in their own rooms. But one of their employees found out about what the Bucks did and had to run and bang on all their doors and wake them up and have an emergency meeting because the Lakers had a game that night. The Lakers decided not to play. The rest of the NBA teams felt pressured to not play as well, and they had a big, big meeting that night. The Bucks did get some heat from the players, and I think it was Jaylen Brown that stood up and said that wasn't fair for them to say that to the Bucks. And again, if they wanted to play, they could have still played. Like, they shouldn't have felt pressure to do anything. Maybe there were some people that wanted to make it seem like it was a collective idea. Mm-hmm. Still in all, like, to me, there are moments in history where you don't have time to think about it, man. You do what's in your heart. But apparently, LeBron James and the Lakers did not want to continue the season. They were willing to walk out. But they had like a collective vote, but the majority of the players voted to continue the season. The weird thing is, I remember I was kind of waiting to find out what was happening. I was in the media dining room, and then all of a sudden, like, word started getting out. And then next thing you know, you see like that one special restaurant everybody goes to. You just see like Luka suddenly walking across the bridge and Anthony Davis walking across, like all these players walking across the bridge to go eat. I said, well, I guess they ain't going nowhere. They're going to get lunch. I mean, like, if they were going somewhere, I don't think they would be rushing to have another meal here before they left, you know. But to me, I think we were so insulated in there. I don't think they realized how much of an impact they were having on the outside by having Black Lives Matter on the court, by having social justice jerseys, by speaking after practices and games and, like, Jamal Murray from the Nuggets having Breonna Taylor on his shoes and breaking down. I think what people were seeing was amazing. For me to see a white player have Ally or Black mm-hmm. Lives Matter on the back of their jersey, mm-hmm. to see players kneel during the anthem, during the entire thing, was emotional at times. Like, touched me at times. I was there when the Clippers decided to continue to play after Donald Sterling.
Yeah.
And I cried because I was hurt that first game. I cried like tears of joy when I saw the Black Lives Matter on the floor and the players kneel and everything like that. And it was funny. It like flipped. Now, all of a sudden, if you didn't kneel, it was a problem. Like, which was weird to me as well. But they ended up switching their mentality and putting the emphasis on voting.
Yeah,
which ultimately opened up basically every arena in the league for voting. You cannot tell me that didn't impact the election, especially in Georgia. The Hawks were actually the first team to open up their arena for the election. And I'm sure that helped the numbers and helped some people feel like they could go to a comfortable place to vote. I think as time passes, you know, we'll look at it in the same way we looked at Ali or what Kaepernick did, or Black Fist in 1968, or Jesse Owens. Like, that was one of the most amazing things in Black sports history. And if there's anything that's disappointing now, is I wish some of the stuff that had transferred over to the season today. Like, there is no Black Lives Matter on the court no more. There is no social justice names on the back of the jersey. The only time they kneeled is when there was a riot at the Capitol. But kind of like, you know, think that the NBA players should think about transferring some of that over to now, but also remember the power they had when they collectively decided not to play.
From the outside, it was also a big deal because you could look at the other sports leagues and see not much happening at all. Right. I mean, to me, every time, and this was so weird over the summer, like, you're talking about pandemic, you're talking about George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and you would go to, but then my phone would be like, here's another sports story. And it would just be Tom Brady goofing off in Tampa Bay. or the NFL going, here's the draft. We're announcing the new, like, just sort of basic, regular sports
like
news.
Nothing was going on.
Like not even social justice, but not even the pandemic is happening. Just basic, this team signed this person. And so that's the thing I really took, is like the NBA is really far ahead of other sports leagues. And then also you can't help but think Last Dance comes out and Michael Jordan has to own up for the Republicans buy sneakers too comment.
Mm. Yeah.
At the same time, it's the first time in my life watching The Last Dance that I heard Michael Jordan say the word racism. And so to me, it was like, this whole era is affecting him as a guy who was famously apolitical. And now he's like putting money into medical clinics in South Carolina or North Carolina and doing all these other things where it's like, to see it sort of like work its magic on a player who was before apolitical is also amazing.
I know that Last Dance is near and dear to your heart. And we're not going to talk about that.
I mean,
as a Bulls enthusiast, I remember I asked you, I'm like, did you go see them play? You're like, yeah, my mom took me and I saw the Bulls.
Yep. No, I got to see Michael Jordan dunk on a white center for the Atlanta Hawks. I think it was John Konkak.
John Konkak sounds about right.
I also wonder if social media would have been good or bad for Michael Jordan.
Oh, no, it would have been a wrap. It would have been a wrap. That wouldn't have been good.
Because I do wonder, like, with the thing that was interesting in the documentary was he only felt like through Ahmad that he had a voice, right? And I've talked to Ahmad Rashad about this. But if he had the Players Tribune, if he had Instagram or a means to tweet out, could he have handled things probably better his way? You know, if he was able to speak out on his own, and which I think was a lot harder to do at that time. But at the same token, there certainly would have been some videos from casinos and clubs.
Yeah.
I remember that one video where you see Michael Jordan dancing in the club, and then somebody put that out. Like the only social media video I ever seen of him, and he wasn't happy about it.
I think that the first time I saw Adam Silver kind of come into his own, the commissioner of the NBA. And seemingly move the NBA in a different direction is the suspension of Donald Sterling because of the racist tape that came out. And it felt like, okay, this is a commissioner that actually is, you know, is saying we're in a new place. But I think about the way the NBA was under David Stern. You know, Donald Sterling was the Clippers owner for a really long time, and he did some terrible things that might not be as...
Way worse than that tape, actually.
The tape is just like the easiest thing to sell to the public, but in terms of what he was doing to his tenants, and I mean, he was a racist, and that was kind of known, and it was tolerated. And, you know, then you have things like Stern making players wear suits when they're on the bench and not playing because there was this image, you know, during the Allen Iverson era that he did not embrace, but said like, no, this is not how young black men in our league dress. And it's very, you know, he didn't say that, but that's essentially what it was. Yeah. Very paternalistic. And also, you know, the famous example is Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf with the Denver Nuggets refusing to stand for the national anthem. And this was, by the way, like people say, well, Kaepernick was a star player. So was, you know, during that time, Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, that was a career year that he was having in his last
quickest jump shot ever.
Oh, God, what an incredible shooter. And he just...
And if you imagine him in the game today, the way he played, this would have been his era.
Yes. And so, you know, all that precedes Adam Silver. So I guess my question is, how much of the changes that have happened are due to Adam Silver being commissioner of the league, and how much of it is just an overall change in society and culture? And of course, having LeBron James as, you know, your leader versus Michael Jordan.
You know, I had the pleasure and the luck of interviewing David Stern about 3 months before he passed. I went to his office in over by Central Park and was just amazed on how hard he was working. Like, somebody had some money, he was working way too hard for me. Like, let me be that rich. I told him, I said, I'll be sitting on a bench eating a hot dog in Central Park, not looking at it. You know, I told him he was always gracious to me and good to me. And I asked him about Donald Sterling, what he would have done. And his answer was, you know, out of respect for Adam, I don't want to say what I would have done, but I feel like Adam did the right thing. I think in a lot of ways, Stern was starting to evolve, and that was basically the mentality of the time he was in. I definitely wish I could talk to him now and see if there were some regrets that he had in terms of Mahmoud and The clothing thing is interesting because I have written about that. And it's funny that black folks, even when they put it, their backs are put against the wall, they figure it out to make it good for them. A lot of these dudes ended up being forced to buy suits and they liked it. They're like, damn, I do look good in these suits, man. And suddenly, like, they're getting endorsement deals that they weren't getting before. And I think they dug the compliments they were getting. But I think the thing was that the dress code was after the Malice in the Palace.
Hold up. Wait a minute.
All right, kids, gather around. Let's talk about the Malice at the Palace. If you are not a fan of the NBA, but you've seen it in clips on YouTube or on TV, you'll notice that right now the NBA is very athletic and beautiful and skill-based. You got like LeBron James soaring through the air to dunk or make beautiful passes. You got Steph Curry shooting from far off, way off outside the three-point line. But back in the 90s and the early 2000s, it wasn't this beautiful and wide open. It was a lot more physical. There's a lot more hard fouls, a lot more jawing between the players, a lot more physicality. And it led to fights. There were occasional fights in the NBA back in that era. Not all the time, but there were fights. Well, it all came to a head at the Malice at the Palace, which was this whole fight slash melee slash riot that took place at the Palace in Auburn Hills in Michigan. It was in November of 2004 at a game between the Indiana Pacers and the home team, the Detroit Pistons. Basically, Pistons center Ben Wallace got fouled hard while making a layup. He was fouled by Pacers forward Ron Artest. Ron Artest was kind of like a Dennis Rodman Jr., like a mercurial, colorful figure who sometimes was a troublemaker. So after Ben Wallace got fouled, he shoved Ron Artest and set off a fight on the court. Again, no big deal in the NBA at that point. It was a fight on the court, bench clearing brawl, no big deal. But after the fight had been broken up, Ron Artest was laying down on the scorer's table and a fan threw a drink at Ron Artest that landed right near him. And Ron Artest wasn't looking in that direction, but he looked up, he saw a guy looking at him, and he charged at that guy thinking that was the guy who threw the drink at him. Of course, it was not. So Ron Artest starts beating up an innocent bystander who's standing next to the guy who threw the drink. Of course, now it's just a brawl. It's a melee. It's an old school bar fight. Everybody's fighting everybody. 7-foot NBA players are fighting like 5-foot-8 fans.
The security trying to somehow restore order. Fans and players are going at it. And the players trying to help each other out. This is a disgrace.
The refs called off the whole game, cleared the arena. They never played the rest of that game. The Associated Press called it the most infamous brawl in NBA history, which is saying a lot because one time a player actually broke another player's face with a punch. That's a whole other story. There's a book written about it. The player's name was Kermit Washington. Read the book. So after the game, the NBA suspended 9 players for a total of 146 games, leading to the players losing $11 million in salary. And Ron Artest was suspended the longest because he ran into the stands. And he was so affected by the whole thing that he ended up changing his name to Meta World Peace to show that he was a new peaceful person. And 5 players got charged with assault. 5 fans got charged with assault. The players got a year of probation and community service. The fans were banned from attending Pistons home games for life. And this fight led to an increase in security between the players and the fans, which of course makes sense. And also a limit of the sale of alcohol in the arenas, which of course also makes sense. And now the game is beautiful and balletic, which is nice. But, you know, I kind of miss a hard elbow every now and again.
It did seem very racist, and several players, including Iverson and Chauncey Billups, Jason Richardson, I believe, said some things about how, well, all of a sudden, we got to change the way we dress because of the Malice in the Palace to make these sponsors feel better about giving the league money. So I wish, like, I could have had a dinner with David Stern, like, off the record, like, and maybe he was stuck in the middle in a weird way and he's just trying to figure his way out of it because the league was on fire. It ended up being oddly a good thing 15 years later. And then they flipped it into what they thought was cool and fashionable. And it's now you see like players like Russell Westbrook are walking on a runway. Because of COVID, they're letting these coaches wear like, they look like breakdancers on the side of the bench now with their tight sweatpants and they're like, you know, their tops and everything. And,
yeah, it's gone the other way. They all look like, it looks like every coach looks like it's laundry day.
it's like way too casual. So when we get back to it, I wonder if, you know, what coaches are going to get dressed up anymore. Maybe they'll like, I saw Juwan Howard with a t-shirt on. Coach, another day. Coach, now, it had some Black History stuff on there that was beautiful, but I'm like, he got a T-shirt on. Just, we at AAU in Vegas.
The day this episode comes out, Thursday, March 11th, is a year to the day that the NBA that shut down the league, suspended play. And I think everybody may have a different day that they realized COVID was real. For me, that was the day. Like, I remember
mine
that
was 2 days before.
Well, yeah, what was yours?
2 days before the Warriors played the Clippers. And this was like the first time that NBA was really trying to show that they were trying to do something about this, but they're starting to figure it out. It's kind of weird now, because when I think about it, it was like, God, that was dangerous. I remember going to the game, being in the media room. All they had was sanitizer everywhere. It was just sanitizer. Every table had sanitizer on it, right?
Yeah.
And I remember a reporter, I'm not going to say his name, but when I see him, I'm going to remind him about this. He was like, oh, man, this is some bullshit. You know, and I don't know why we doing all this and why we got to sanitize and this thing is overwhelming. And I'm going to give y'all a hug. I'm going to get close to y'all. And I remember like hugging them like this and everything. There's a guy who was a photographer for the Warriors. And I don't know if he wants his name out. I'll just leave it at that. He had like the mask with the valve on it and everything. And
yeah.
Looked like he was like at that time, you thought he was, you know, going to some Armageddon movie or something. And I was like, God damn, man, you ain't playing, huh? I remember being on the court.
Yeah.
It was the last time I was on the court outside the bubble, you know. And he's like, man, this thing's real, man. I'm really scared. This thing is real. And I always remember that's when it kind of hit me. Is when he said that.
Yeah.
This thing is not a joke, man. This could be catastrophic. That night, I ended up getting a drink with Mark Hughes, one of the Clippers' assistant GMs, at the Modernist. Have you been to the Modernist?
Mm-mm.
I got to take you there. You'll like that. It's like one of the private speakeasies in San Francisco.
Yeah, you know all the spots.
Yeah, so we get a drink at the Modernist. I think that's the last time I've been inside a place to get a drink.
Wow.
2 days later, I'm watching League Pass, and they're like, there's an alert. The Oklahoma City Thunder and the Utah Jazz have just left the court. And I, like, got it on my phone. I immediately turned on League Pass, and I'm like, oh, they're not going to play. They're not going to play. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, the Pelicans were playing Sacramento that night. I live in the Bay Area. I'm like, the Pelicans-Sacramento game is the last game of the NBA slate, and this might shut down for a while. And I remember I got in my car, and I'm like, I called the Kings. I said, I'm coming to this game. And I got in the car, and I got over by just close to Vallejo, and they canceled the game. And that was it. And the rest of the sports world followed, and then it was definitely a different world. And it's amazing that's about to come up.
And to think that, like, you get to the All-Star game this weekend, and the NBA seems to have been pretty aggressive about the way they've dealt with COVID in ways that other sports leagues have not been. I would like to know your perspective on that. And also, to get to the All-Star weekend and to then have Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons not be able to play in the game.
Yeah.
Because the NBA is that strict. What are your thoughts about how they've done this past year and also that moment?
Well, I wish it was more uniform, even with the media, for example. Like, Golden State games, they test you. Shout out to the Warriors and shout out to the Brooklyn Nets. They make you take a rapid COVID test and you can't enter the arena unless you get one. That actually has been a salvation to me, because that was, I've been going to Warriors games in a lot of ways for the free COVID test, you know, and the instant results, you know. But I went to a Pelicans game and it was like wild, wild west in there. The thing that broke my heart, man, is my good friend Sekou Smith, you know, God rest his soul. We were actually in the bubble together.
Oh, wow.
He is one of my closest friends in the industry. When he got there, because he got there about 60% the way through into the bubble, he showed up. Like, I snuck him food during his quarantine because he didn't like what they were giving him. So I, like, you know, looked out, and we would ride bikes every day. We would talk about family every day. We would get on the bus to go to the games at the same time. We basically started covering the NBA at the same time. I just remember that call I got from him, or I called him actually the day that James Harden got traded. to check on him and see, you know, what he thought of the trade. And that's when he told me he had COVID. And 2 weeks later, he was gone, man. And so the NBA put up a picture of Sekou Smith and had a media seat and for him and flowers. And I was like, that was a reminder of perhaps why we all shouldn't be here. And I'm nervous for the players right now because, you know, they're so young that I think a lot of them probably just feel like they don't need to take the vaccine. And look, man, I'm not going to tell anybody what to put in their body. And, you know, certainly there are people of all ages that don't want to or against it for one reason or another. But I'm praying that most everybody does. I see what it did to my friend. I've seen what it did to other people. And I don't want them to face that ever. But a bunch of players went to Miami during the break. Oof. Like it sounded like about a third of the league. So I am curious, and when this runs, there'll be probably be some news out on how many players won't be playing because, you know, they got cabin fever and went to Miami and wanted to turn up.
I wanted to ask you a question just about Becky Hammon.
Yeah.
Assistant coach on the San Antonio Spurs. And certainly she's, you know, seems incredibly qualified to be the first female head coach in the NBA. Do you see that happening anytime soon?
I'm just laughing. More qualified than Steve Nash, no shade.
right.
True.
Like, has actually done this job.
I'm just saying, like, capacity. I'm not mad at Steve Nash, but that, you know, if we're going to be clear about what qualifications look like.
Well, here's the thing, like, the players of power certainly have influence on who their coach is. Mm. So I'm sure Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving had a big influence on Steve Nash being selected. Because somebody could say is, well, why didn't they get a black coach there either? You know, they have never publicly talked about it, and they might be mad for me saying it, but I'm sure they had a – and I love Steve Nash. I've known him since I was in college, and he certainly has an amazing basketball mind. My hope for Becky, my hope for all coaches of color, men, women, is that they just do a fair search. Minnesota didn't do it. If they didn't want David Vanderpool, that's fine. But I don't see why, especially with the All-Star break coming, that they couldn't have done a diverse coaching search. If the guy they picked is the guy they wanted it to, in the end, so be it. But, you know, why couldn't they interview Becky? Why couldn't they interview a long list of black assistant coaches, associate head coaches? I think people beat up the NBA so much, but the NBA doesn't own the teams. The owners that own those teams ultimately make the decision on, like, who their coach is going to be, who's going to run their organization. So I know for a fact that anytime one of those big jobs open, the NBA's Deputy Commissioner Mark Tatum will send them a list. Like, hey, here's some people of color, some women that you definitely should consider for the job. Now, they might be using that information to start their fires. I don't know how much they're really looking at this information. I think the good thing is now that teams know that they're being watched and they can't just make moves without being criticized. But do they care? Ultimately, they get 2 weeks bad press and then get who they want. But to answer your question, will Becky Hammon get a chance? Depends on the owner of that team and if they're willing to have a diverse search and give her the opportunity to interview and prove that she's worthy of the job, and she certainly has the experience to be worthy.
Speaking of shitty ownership, as a Knicks fan, is there any way to get rid of James Dolan besides a secret racist recording? Is there anything else we can do? Because I'm just sick of, like, oh, the Knicks are having a great year. They're a 500 team. We're not having a great year. We're a 500 team.
Don't look good, Hoff. if he ain't left by now, he ain't going nowhere. You know, the one thing it's interesting about him, like, we could beat up the man. He actually had a black president in Steve Mills, a black general manager in Scott Perry, and a black head coach in David Fizdale. And which was sad to me were you had black players saying nobody want to play for the Knicks. We finally got a team that has black representation. But y'all don't want to play for them or at least let them give you a sales pitch. I think the thing you got to hope for with Dolan is because he can't really go to games right now or there's not a lot of crowd that, like, he's not in the spotlight. And hopefully he'll just kind of stay in the background. And as long as he stays away, at least I think the Knicks have some good people to try to put things in place. But you kind of want to just lock him in a room somewhere and make sure he doesn't say or do anything.
Thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it, Mark. Good to see you. Yeah, hopefully, Mark, We'll see each other in real life soon.
Yes, sir. Got to go on one of those walks again, man.
We do. Yeah. I enjoyed that. Yeah.
Mark J. Spears is the senior NBA writer for The Undefeated. Check out his work at theundefeated.com.
Mark's most recent book is The Spencer Haywood Rule, Battles, Basketball, and the Making of an American Iconoclast. That's it for this week. Thanks to Dr. Rhea Boyd and Mark J. Spears.
We always want to hear what you think about the conversations we're having on Politically Reactive.
Leave us a voicemail at 917-477-6525.
That's 917-477-6525.
And keep your comments and questions coming on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram with the hashtag Politically Reactive.
And rate and review the show wherever you get your podcast. It gets the word out, and yes, we do read them. Because, you know, we have time on our hands, and we'd probably read them anyway because we're egomaniacs.
Go to betweenusaboutus.org. It's great information about vaccines that is not just applicable to Black people. You could share it with anyone in your life who's worried about getting the vaccine, or maybe you could share it with yourself if you're worried about getting the vaccine.
Also, Kamau and I have Netflix specials. Kamau's is Private School Negro, and mine is Warn Your Relatives. Netflix hasn't pulled them yet. Hopefully they never will. So why don't you, watch them?
I don't think they pull content down unless something goes wrong. Hopefully
nothing will ever go wrong.
Hopefully we'll stay in the not wrong category. Politically Reactive is a production of Topic Studios and Warner Media Podcast Network. Executive producers are Maria Zuckerman and Christy Gressman.
And me, Harika Nabolu.
And me, W. Kamau Bell.
The show is produced by Matt Martin, Malachi Seeger Sakir, and Kelly Rafferty. Will Stanton engineers and mixes the show.
And thanks, as always, to Brontez Purnell for providing music for the show. Thanks for listening to Politically Reactive.
So I got a question for you, because this has always been fascinating to me. In L.A. and in New York. Y'all don't love the Nets at all, huh?
I mean, and I... Let me finish.
You got Kevin Durant,
yeah,
Kyrie Irving, James Harden, and just got Blake Griffin. But I love the loyalty of the Knicks fan. They don't...
Yeah, no, it's irrational.
They could sign Jesus Christ, and they'd be like, nah, dog. Nah, man.
I mean, here's the thing to me. This is how... I'm a Knicks fan, kind of. Like, I'm a Knicks fan in that, like, I miss the 90s.
You're a Knicks,
Knicks
fan because you wouldn't have asked me that question. You wouldn't care that much if you weren't a Knicks fan. You're not a Knicks fan, kind of.
I want to love them again because they're so connected to my childhood. And certainly, like, the 90s Knicks represented New York better than any other team I can imagine, other than, like, the Brooklyn Dodgers of, like, the 40s, right? Like the Knicks were tough. They represent New York. They fought for every possession. Like,
they were overly confident with no reason to be. Yeah,
this is not about our losses to the Bulls, Kamau. This has nothing to do with you.
Or not making the putback layup.
We have to keep. So anyway, all I'm saying is Brooklyn doesn't have that legacy, right? Brooklyn, you know, I live in Brooklyn. I don't even live that far from Barclays, but they don't have that legacy that's connected to, like, my childhood. If
Hold on. In the last 25 years, there's been one franchise in the New York area that's been to the NBA Finals twice. What team was that?
They were in New Jersey, Mark. That is not the same thing. That is not
the
same
thing.
And the
last time the other team won a championship, I was... Almost 1 year. I was 1 year old.